Welcome to Microdigressions. This is Spencer Case, and this is episode 51. It's a new year, 2024, first new episode of 2024, and I'm doing some things differently this time. This is the first episode that I will record video for. You should be able to find this episode on YouTube, as well as the podcatchers where you normally find it in purely auditory form. So new year is a good time to start thinking about new beginnings and new life and things like that. But I think it's also a good time to reflect on what has passed, you know, the people we have lost in the previous year, be they celebrities or people we know personally. I think this is a good time to reflect on the topic of death. And, you know, I've heard this term, the human condition. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I take it something like the fundamental facts of human life that pertain to everyone, abstracting away, you know, the particularities of individual lives. And so if there is a human condition, this whole death thing is central to that, the fact that our lives are finite and we seem to be built in a way that we mostly can't stand that thought. So here to talk with me about this issue is my friend Travis Timmerman from Seton Hall University. Travis, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Spencer?
I'm pretty good. And I'm happy to have this copy, which you sent me, of your book, Exploring the Philosophy of Death and Dying, edited by you and Michael Cholby. I used many articles from this in my death and dying class here at Bowling Green State University last semester. So I guess I want to ask you a bit about what got you started on that project.
Yeah, sure. So first, thank you for using that text. It took 4 years. I actually started working on that with Michael when I was in my last year of graduate school at Syracuse University. And Michael started an organization called the International Association for the Philosophy of Death and Dying. It's quite a mouthful. And we had hosted a biannual conference that's still continuing to this day. And many of us in that organization had taught courses on the philosophy of death. But at the time that we started the project, there were very few readers. There were very few texts that were aimed at introducing the kind of core issues in the field in a way that was accessible to people without a background in philosophy. Some have since come out since we started that project, because this was way back in 2016. And there are a lot of, you know, there's good ones out there besides ours. But we wanted to provide a series of short essays that made use of classic works, some works of literature, and then paired it with the most contemporary interventions into the debate that falls broadly under the same questions. And to do so in a way that someone could take, who's just, you know, a smart, motivated person, but maybe doesn't have any background in philosophy. I also selfishly, you know, I'm going to teach this class every year at Seton Hall. I do. And I wanted to just have all of the work done for that class. You know, I wanted to have a textbook. I wanted to have the prep done for that. I wanted to have the PowerPoints and the, you know, essay questions and all of that. So putting it into this book and then making it available for everyone just also made it personally easier for me.
Well, anytime you're producing a book, like a book proposal, as you know, we both know, going through the book proposal process more than once, you want to have something that you can say, there's actually a need for this. This actually feels a demand. And I think that's definitely true of this book. So I want to jump now into the topic of death and dying itself, I suppose. So one thing that I saw last year, just, I don't know, scrolling on the internet somehow, I came across this and it stuck with me for some reason. It was an interview with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito, who was his co-star in the movie Twins. I don't know if you saw that sort of comedy from the 80s. Anyway, and he was reflecting on something he had said on Howard Stern's show a few years ago, where he says, I'm not fearful of death. I'm just pissed off. And he was sort of elaborating on that theme. And he's just like, I just can't believe it that I'm going to lose my body no matter what I do. And I'm not going to be able to go to the gym and pump iron anymore. I'm not going to be able to run on the beach. all this stuff. And, you know, it made me really think about this issue of our vulnerability to death, how universal it is. And here you got somebody like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was Mr. Universe like 10 times or something, as an action movie star, and was governor of California and married a Kennedy and has all this money. Like, he's successful in so many domains of life, and yet he's completely helpless to this problem of death, that he's going to lose it all. In fact, maybe even more vulnerable than the rest of us, because it seems like he has more to lose. And it seems like that just really highlights for me what a significant issue this is for us to think about and to deal with.
Yeah, I'll have to check out that interview. I was born in the 80s and grew up in the 90s, so of course I've seen Twins and most of the films that Arnold Schwarzenegger has made. And I think you expressed that very nicely. It's certainly true that a unifying feature of all living creatures is that they're going to die. And even those who can have the reason to be most optimistic about the prospects for what you might call contingent immortality, if we could reverse the aging process, cure diseases, make one immune to various ailments that would take our life, even those people should think that death is coming for them. It's that, you know, even if you could upload your consciousness into a computer, for instance, you're not going to survive the heat death of the universe. That said, there are, of course, some religious people who seem to express no doubt about their immortality. There are others, you might think, I believe I'm immortal, but nevertheless, there's a non-trivial chance I'm going to die, and that could be enough to be anxiety-inducing. But if you're really certain that you will continue to exist in an afterlife in some form, you might think that what happens is you'll suffer a mere bodily death, but whatever constitutes your personal identity, maybe some immaterial soul, that will live on forever. But it's interesting that the, and this is anecdotal, that number of people that purport to hold that view, very few of them seemed unconcerned about the prospect of what they might think of as mere bodily death. And I think that suggests that even the typical extremely committed religious person who believes in an afterlife thinks that there's a non-trivial chance that they will cease to exist when they die. And that is something that it doesn't generate fear. I like the pissed off locution. It doesn't generate fear in you, but it's still something that warrants a negative attitude. It might not be bad in and of itself. My view is it's not bad in and of itself, but it's bad because it prevents you from missing out on all sorts of things that are good in and of themselves. And even if you couldn't reasonably expect to get those things, it's still unfortunate or lamentable or regrettable or should piss you off, I think, that you're not going to get all of those things.
So have you ever had it happen where there's some idea that you'd never come into contact with before and suddenly it's like hitting you left and right? You're hearing it all over the place. That happened to me last year with like three different books that I happened to come across, yours being one of them, this anthology being one of them, that brought forward this idea that the fear of death is actually much more important to our everyday psychology than people imagine. So, well, here's one way that might be true. So according to Oliver Berkman, the author of 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals, he says that the real problem with, you know, scheduling advice, people trying to fit everything in their schedules, is they haven't actually reckoned with the fact that they're mortal and that they have to make these trade-offs. And so the sort of big picture thinking about death and dying and the finiteness, finitude of our lives, that actually percolates down into everyday sort of anxieties, the fear that you don't want to have to face the fact that you have to make these trade-offs. Another place I came across this is Miguel Unamuno's view, which was in the Tragic Sense of Life, where he sees like ordinary ambition, like the ambition of artists to create a great work of art, probably my ambition to write some really great piece of writing, which is a huge motive for me. This is actually a sort of subliminated desire for immortality, the desire for a kind of terrestrial immortality. Even if it's not true immortality, it sort of extends your influence or something beyond your mortal lifespan in a way. And he sees people who are seeking some kind of legacy. It's actually a fear of death that is motivating them. And the third place I came across this was the psychologist Ernest Becker. Actually, I think he might just be a polymath. I'm not sure if he's a psychologist in particular, but he had psychological theories. And he came up with the roots of what is now, I think it's called terror management theory, that a lot of our psychological processes are actually sort of adaptations to allow us to cope with terror that we otherwise can't deal with. So he suspects that, you know, I mean, you think that kids first hear about death and they're appalled and horrified to learn about this, you know, this thing, death, that's going to come and take everything away one day. But then you grow up and you're like, oh, I'm not scared of death. I'm just going to live my life to the fullest. And when my time comes, or at least I hear a lot of adults say this. And he thinks that this might be like a very carefully cultivated self-delusion, right? We conceal from ourselves just how terrified we are of this. And it actually sort of like this delusion can crop up in places. It's always sort of there in the back of our mind. He has one great quote from somebody else whose name I forget. But he says, the skull grins in at the banquet. It's like, oh, that's a great line. Like, no matter where you are, no matter how fully you're living life, there's always that needling bit of uncertainty, that needling bit of like anxiety over this fundamental fact. So I don't know if those theories are true, but they're interesting and I'd never heard them before. And I was interested on your take on this issue.
Yeah, I'm happy to give my take, which I must admit may not be exciting. And at least wading into the evidential value of terror management theory, there's not much that I can say since I'm not a psychologist. I will say, I think most positively, that I really enjoy reading the work of Miguel Unamuno, and we have an excerpt of his in Exploring the Philosophy of Death and Dying from The Tragic Sense of Life. And he captures very eloquently, almost poetically, I think, a sense of existential dread that at least a lot of people have in the Hunger of Immortality section of them. The extent to which that's widespread and plays a role in our decision making is not something that he weighs in on in any precise way. And it's not something that I, as a philosopher, am qualified to weigh on, because that just seems like an empirical question. When I've taught that has resonated with a number of my students who are, you know, young and have lots of prospective life ahead of them. But of course, there's questions about like how representative the population is, and the extent to which people might say that this captures what they're thinking, but maybe there's some difference or some space between what they're actually thinking and what's going on in the text. And there's a bunch of other reasons to sort of doubt this. But I really like his work. I haven't read the Berkman. The way that you stated the thesis seemed kind of strong, and I don't want to strawman him because I haven't read him. But I worry that the way you said it seemed maybe to overstate the case a little bit. I mean, people aren't, when they plan for retirement, they're not planning to make enough money to live indefinitely in the future, right? They're not making plans to try to set up trusts for their great, 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 great grandchildren and so on. I mean, there's all sorts of things that I think people would be doing differently if they actually thought that they didn't have to make these choices that were constrained by time. But I'm sure Berkman's actual view is a lot maybe more nuanced or maybe stated a bit simply because I know it's a sort of self-help book that's written for a popular audience. So I don't want to present this as actual criticisms of Berkman. Becker, Ernest Becker, is an interesting case. I did read The Denial of Death when I was in graduate school, but it's been more than a decade since I've done that. But this is another case, though, where I think he states the case in such strong terms that I'm antecedently skeptical that what he's saying is true to the degree that he claims, right? So he's arguing that, like, humans' innate and all-encompassing fear of death drives him to achieve immortality, I'm putting in scare quotes, through, you know, various culture creations. Like, you know, you mentioned writing a book that hopefully will be read on throughout the ages. And he thinks that this ever-present fear of death that's looming over us is, like, forming our character in these really drastic ways. And that is contingent upon this sort of implicit denial that we are mortal. Is that true? I mean, I don't know. So terror management theory did come out of that, or was inspired by Becker's work. Becker's own method was this kind of, like, post-Freudian cultural critique that isn't employing the rigorous empirical methods that I think are necessary to, like, answer that sort of question. So for something that strong, I'm just think there's something in his work that captures the imagination of a lot of people. But he makes broad, sweeping social claims about this supposed denial of the fear of death and the way that it fundamentally shapes our character. That's just, if I recall correctly, not supported by his methodology. Now, that's not to say terror management theory isn't well supported by the science. That's, I think, a more modest claim about this just conflict between having a kind of desire to continue living at least for a very long time, if not indefinitely, while also realizing that we're going to die. And there very well could be a great deal of value to that I'm just not qualified to weigh in on as a philosopher. I mean, I know that there's people who say that this is better explained by different psychological theses, coalitional psychology or collective theories of self-defense, which I mean, I don't know, maybe not. I have no idea. But there's a range of alternative explanations in the psychological literature that have been offered as critiques of terror management theory that could very well better explain the data that I'm not qualified to weigh on. And I know that there's, like, you know, replication problem in general in the sciences and with respect to terror management theory as well. So those are all complicated things that are above my pay grade. And that's why I'm happy to sort of sit in my armchair and think about, you know, would immortality be good? How should you feel about it? Would death be bad? Without having to weigh in on these more complex empirical questions.
Well, since I have read the Berkman, I will say I think the idea is not that people, like, don't literally know that they have a finite amount of time, but I think the idea is, like, the practical implications of finitude tend to elude us, and we tend to, like, put off thinking, what is it that I'm going to have to prioritize? You know, what's going to go by the wayside? So that seems plausible to me. But yeah, I don't know about some of these really strong claims. I get that sense with Becker too. It's like, yeah, even he seemed to think, yeah, this seems kind of unfalsifiable. Like, how could you ever argue against, like, you're motivated by some subliminal thing that you think you're not motivated by, and it confirms my theory that you can't detect that it's there. So I think some skepticism is warranted about some of this, but I still had never really thought about this idea that perhaps the fear of death could be playing, like, a much larger role than we realize. You know, it doesn't not just something that crops up in our psychology if a maniac is chasing us with a knife or something like that. I want to move on to what death is. So there was this discussion of this. Is it flipping open to the legal definition of death here from the Uniform Determination of Death Act, and it gives a definition here that, like, no philosopher could love, right? Like, that was my reaction to that. So I'll just read it. So this was passed, I think, in 1981. Was it the?
Sorry, yeah, 1981, the Uniform Determination of Death Act, that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it says, an individual who has sustained either irreversible cessation of circulatory and respiratory functions or irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem, is dead. Okay. So a couple of things jump out at me about that. One, it's a disjunction, and maybe this is just a bias of philosophers, but every time I see a disjunction in a definition, I'm like, what do the two disjuncts have in common? You know? And the other thing is, if you look at that first disjunct there, that would seem to imply, am I right? Am I right about this? Right? Like if you lost both irreversible, you lost circulatory and respiratory functions irreversibly. And how would you know irreversibly? Like it seems like you couldn't know that at any determinate point. Like if there was some sort of way that both of those functions could be artificially sustained, like indefinitely, like who's to say whether you could one day there'd be a technology for you to recover those functions. But also, even if it's guaranteed that you couldn't recover them, it seems like this is compatible with your brain functioning and your being conscious and alive and I guess I can't say alive, conscious and talking to me, and yet you would be dead by this definition.
Right. That's right. So there's a lot to say about this. First, this is definitely not, and I don't think any philosopher ever accepted this, as a definition that picks out the necessary and sufficient conditions for being dead at the most fundamental level. Really, this was proposed as a way to determine whether somebody is dead. I mean, that was the practical purpose of it. So it wasn't presented as like, what is, if we're doing a conceptual analysis of death, what is that concept picking out in the real world? And let's give a joint carving account of that. And that's why the disjunct might not thought to be as problematic as you just pointed out, because you're right that that definition allows in science fiction scenarios, at least for now science fiction scenarios, a sentient being whose sentience is maintained, but they lack circulatory and respiratory functions to be declared dead. But in practice, at least as of now, if that first disjunct is satisfied, then you're not going to have somebody who's conscious. And there's a history of this. I mean, the definition before that, it was like up until the 1960s, death was not offered as like the criteria of death, but the determinant of death was indicated by an irreversible cessation of a person's heartbeat. And so that was the way that you would try to determine whether somebody was dead before. And then that changed as medical technology improved. So once the ventilator was invented, you could then keep severely brain damaged humans seemingly alive. But they would be dead on this way to try to determine death. So it was really, once that medical technology changed and there was more success in using organs to, for life-saving transplants and non-life-saving ones, led that Harvard committee to recommend this version of brain death as a new standard. And just like that first definition, as medical technology changes, then it looks like whether somebody would be, considered dead on this determinant of death would change. Condition in both of the disjuncts is going to raise those sorts of problems. So the philosopher in you, I know the philosopher in me thinks, well, in what sense is it irreversible? Do you mean like it's not physically possible? It's not nomologically possible, not metaphysically possible. If it's not metaphysically possible, maybe no one has ever died. What great news. Or if it's not logically possible, well, then no one has ever died. Some, you know, all powerful deity could presumably resuscitate all of these people. All right. So, it might be valuable as, practical determinant of death, though that is controversial for a variety of reasons, but it's certainly not going to pick out the criteria of death. So let me say one thing about why it's controversial, and then I'm happy to talk a little bit about what criteria of death might be offered as better explanations, although I'm not sure if they'll have any more practical value. I mean, so one reason that this is controversial, even as a determiner of death, is that the tests that they use often to pick out whether somebody is brain dead or not doesn't test for the cessation of all brain functions. So there's some cases where somebody has been considered to have met that criteria for brain death, but they still have like a warm body with a beating heart. They still grow if they're in a coma, or I mean, if they're hooked up in the hospital with no conscious experience, they might still like go through puberty. And that most likely happens because in some cases, the pituitary gland or the hypothalamus are still functioning. So it's not, I mean, so it's one, it's not clear whether that criteria is in fact met, or if, it's not met, but we can't tell given the test. But two, some people think that if this person isn't actually dead, according to whatever the correct, like fundamental features are that determine whether somebody is alive or not, like that, that matters morally. And, using brain death as a criteria for using, taking organs to use for organ transplants or something, they might think that that is immoral if the person's actually alive, even if they have no conscious experience and there's no prospect of them having any additional conscious experience. Okay. So that's the first thing. My own personal view is that the prudential value in a life is contingent upon the possibility of having conscious experience. So even if brain death is not tracking death, if you're accurately testing for it, if it tracks the viability of continued conscious experience, I think that's what matters morally for declaring somebody as dead and then using their organs for organ transplant. But that is a controversial claim. Okay. So I'll pause there for a minute and then I can talk a little bit about maybe what candidates are for the criteria of death, but I wanted to see if you had any reaction to that.
Well, my reaction is to ask a question that might take us on a completely other, completely different sort of digression, but what the hell? It's my podcast. I can do that. So I share your intuition that it seems like from my point of view, at least, definitely, it seems as though what's death versus what's permanent cessation of consciousness, but not death. I don't really care so much about that, right? Being in a permanent coma seems as bad as being dead to me, right? On the other hand, I do have these intuitions, like if somebody were to shoot one of the people you described, one of the bodies, to describe it neutrally, you described that is still growing and breathing and all of this, but there's nothing going on upstairs, like consciousness wise. That still seems something bad has happened. That could just be a misleading intuition, but it's still one that I have. I'm wondering your reaction to that.
Yeah, I mean, I can feel the pull of that intuition, and I think I'm not sure if misleading is the right word to describe it, but I think someone that holds my view has the explanatory resources to account for that. So, I mean, people might think that there's posthumous duties to those who have passed on. You might think that you owe it to someone, either because it's good for them to fulfill a promise or satisfy their desires even once they're dead, or because you think there's moral reason to do so, irrespective of whether it affects how well their life went for them. And causing bodily injury, if they're hooked up in a ventilator, could reasonably thwart what you can expect. Would thwart what you reasonably expect lots of people's desires to be. In the same way that you could expect that they probably wouldn't want you to dig up their grave and desecrate their body. You might think there's just some uncertainty here. So if you're needlessly killing someone who's not an organ donor and hasn't agreed to have the organs used to save other people's lives, if they're no longer conscious, even if it's a small chance, That just seems like a, you know, gratuitous way of cutting off potential. I mean, who knows what medical technology will allow people to do decades in the future. And if you're cutting it off to just shoot someone for, I don't know, the way to fill in the details of the case makes it sound like they're just doing it for fun or because they don't care or whatever. Like that seems bad because you're taking a sort of moral risk with no, you know, no higher payoff that you get from doing that. So there's ways to fill in the details differently where, then I would maybe think that would be okay under certain conditions. But the most immediate conditions that I imagine when you give a case like that makes me think there's lots of things that we could say about why someone is doing something, if not wrong, at least extremely vicious and morally risky and condemnable in various ways.
Okay. So I guess I want to ask your opinion on how death should be defined. It seems to me that there's no like theory neutral way of doing this, right? So if there is a soul that can be separated from the body, then it seems like that's how we should define death, as the separation of the soul from the body. And actually, I'm also assuming that and separation of the soul from the body is what happens in at least most of the cases where we say that person is dead. So if that kind of dualism is true, then it seems like that's how death ought to be defined. If it's not true, then death ought to be defined differently, maybe in terms of, I don't know, maybe in terms of the level of entropy overcoming an organism or something like that. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if that kind of dualism is true, which is a big if, I'd want to distinguish between like mere bodily death that's referring to this biological account of death. That's picking out a concept that I think a lot of people seem to have in mind. Even if they're religious, they apply it to various sentient beings that they don't think are going to have an afterlife. So, you know, non-human animals. And then the death of the person, where the death of the person would be something that results in the permanent cessation of one's existence, which would be, I guess, in this case, a soul. If we're assuming that that kind of dualism is false, and my own personal view is that it is, then the answer gets no less complicated, right? So generally, what I think the criterion should pick out is if there's a single phenomenon out in the world that we apply the concept death to, that the conditions will be partly determined by how we use that concept. And then if it is picking something, we'd want to give the most joint carving fundamental criteria. And there's this question about like whether that's possible. And I should preface these comments with this is not my specialty within the philosophy of death. So take what I say with a grain of salt in every case, but especially in this case. But in that case, I'm not sure that there's a single kind of joint carving phenomenon that we can pick out with how we use death. So, I mean, one way to go is the biological account, some biological account that you mentioned. In the book, John Lizza defends an account of brain death, and he gives various arguments for it. But one does say this hinges on cases of personal identity. You know, imagine that Waldo from the Where's Waldo books of our youth is decapitated, and his body is hooked up to a machine that keeps homeostasis intact, and his head is hooked up to a machine where he maintains sentience and can communicate with people, and that's where his conscious experience lies. And he thinks, well, where did Waldo go? Now we have two different organisms, and anecdotally, they both seem alive, or pre-theoretically, they both seem alive. And we thought Waldo was in the single organism before. Where is he now? Is he in the body with no conscious experience, or in the brain, or in the head? And he thinks clearly he's in the head. So we should go with a kind of brain death definition. And what's interesting about Lizza and people that like that sort of view is they take into account the use and the social conditions and moral reasons They build that into the definition. And contrasted with that in the book, we have Michael Nair Collins give the one that you alluded to earlier. So he gives a purely biological account. It's just when entropy overwhelms homeostasis. So his view, when the organism, the living organism in question, be it human or non-human animal or a creature that's not even sentient, like, you know, bacteria, when that organism no longer resists entropy, when its ability to preserve physiologic stability is lost, or when the organism has transitioned from consuming energy and actively maintaining homeostasis to disintegration and decay, then he thinks the organism has died. That's what the concept of death picks out at the most fundamental level. And maybe that's right, or maybe Liz is right. I don't know. Or maybe they're both wrong. We use the concept of death in a way that extends beyond organic creatures. Right now, it's often just in like science fiction. We refer to like sentient robots dying in narrative fiction, but that might be a reality, in the near future. And that seems like a perfectly felicitous use of the term death. You know, when I see that in, say, a science fiction film or read it in a story or something like that, I don't think they're misapplying the concept or they're using it in a very obviously metaphorical way or something like that. I mean, they're picking out something that results in the permanent cessation of a being that had an interest in continued future or something like that. But if the term death can be used that broadly, then I'm not sure that there's some single joint carving phenomenon that we're picking out by the term. It might really be picking out a variety of different concepts that are interrelated to one another. So in the same way that colloquially we'll use the term harm in a variety of different contexts, but they really pick out more fundamental concepts. So sometimes we mean intrinsic harm, something that's bad in and of itself. Sometimes we mean extrinsic harm, something that's not bad in and of itself, but it leads to something bad or prevents something good. Sometimes we mean all things considered harm. Sometimes we mean pro tanto harm. I mean, there's just a variety of more fundamental things that the colloquial use of that concept covers. And my suspicion, as somebody that doesn't actually do research in this area, is it's a viable possibility that the same thing is true with the colloquial use of our term death.
Yeah, good. So I was thinking, with the brain death account, clearly it suffers from a lack of generality if you wanted this to be universally applicable, because plants die if you don't water them, and there's no brain involved in that process. So you might think that that is an argument in favor of the entropy overcoming homeostasis view, but there might be something to be said, notwithstanding my hostility for disjunctive definitions. It just might be the case that ideally we would have a unified definition, but if we investigate a phenomenon in a particular way and discover that there's actually an irreducible plurality here, we just have to be pluralists of a kind about that thing. So Thomas Reed thought this about personal identity. He thought the identity conditions of persons are just going to be different than the identity, like this, like what it is for something to persist over time. And then that is going to just be different for persons than it is for material objects like the ship of Theseus or something. And so it does seem like, yeah, we might just have to be pluralist about death here. There might not be one single concept that we're getting at here. It might be one thing for plants and another thing for human beings and another thing for robots, potentially. And another thing for angels, if those exist. So, yeah, that might be right.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to ask whether you think there's a substantive difference between having a disjunctive definition of death versus saying for each of the disjuncts, that's picking out some joint carving phenomenon, and they're just distinct phenomena. I like the latter route, which is covering biological living things that are not sentient, or this, which could cover sentient things. I would think there's not some concept here that we should be pluralist about. There's just three distinct concepts that are related in some way, and maybe we use the term death to refer to each of them. But really, if we're paying attention to the differences, there's just three fundamentally different things.
Yeah. So is this a completely general challenge about the possibility of being a pluralist about anything?
Yeah. It's not to rule out the possibility, but I, in general, I think that's the route that I would want to go.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Yeah, so if there are three different concepts, in virtue of what do we apply the same label to them when we're speaking as philosophers and not, you know, lay people or something? I'm not sure. Maybe some kind of family resemblance or something, or maybe it really is just shorthand for what you're saying. That question was occurring to me even as I was describing it. I thought there's probably some paper out there that I haven't read about the coherence of being a pluralist at the most abstract level, but I don't know what it is.
I don't know either. And if there's not a paper about that, somebody should think about that issue specifically and write that paper so I can read it and learn.
So one of the articles in your anthology argues, I thought, pretty persuasively in favor of the view that there are states of being that are neither dead nor alive, that something that was once alive could be in. So I thought that was interesting. Do you want to say something about that?
Yes, and I'm convinced by that too. So of course you might think objects that are always inanimate are neither dead nor alive. But what's interesting about Cody Gilmore's chapter is that he makes a strong case that something that is unequivocally alive at one point can then cease to be alive without having died. So he talks about this in terms of what he calls the paradox of cryptobiosis. And that's, you get cryptobiosis when there's an organism that was once living that's no longer showing any visible signs of life, and when its metabolic activity becomes hardly measurable, or maybe comes reversibly to a standstill. So the real life examples that he uses are a frozen embryo in a lab, or to take a creature, a tardigrade, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, it said it's a tiny insect-like animal with eight legs and a multi-lobed brain. Sounds horrifying. A tardigrade can dehydrate, enter a period of cryptobiosis, and then in response to normal environmental changes, rehydrates and then returns to an active state. So seems like it was alive before it went into the state of cryptobiosis. Seems like it's alive when it comes out of that. Doesn't seem like it's alive while it's in cryptobiosis, and it doesn't seem like it's dead either. You might think people who are cryogenically frozen, I mean, in actuality, many people who are cryogenically frozen are done frozen posthumously, but you could cryogenically freeze someone while they're alive. And then it's unclear whether they're dead or not at that point. The extension of the concept seems to run out where they don't fit neatly into the category of being alive or dead. And then one other science fiction example, because I love those. Fred Feldman, I believe it's in his book Confrontations with the Reaper, has an example where imagine you take a rat or some, you know, rodent or some living creature that's made up of hundreds of millions or trillions of living cells. And you can put it into the machine, and what a machine does is it separates all of the living cells without killing any of the living cells that compose the creature in question. And the rat, it seems, definitely went out of existence when you put it into the machine. But all the living parts that made up the rat, all of those still continue to live. Did the rat die in that case? Maybe. I don't know what death amounts to exactly, but that seems like at least another candidate where the rat ceased to exist without dying.
A sponge. You can literally do that with a sponge, even in the actual world, without any special technology. Take it and, like, you know, run a cheese grater over it or something and chop it up into bits, and then it can reassemble. Is it the same sponge or not? I don't know what the identity conditions for sponges are, but all the cells
still be there.
Right. Yeah. So this raises interesting questions about identity conditions. And as you mentioned earlier, whether we should think they're different for persons and non-persons. But right. Yeah. You could do that same thing with that sea creature and sponge. And, It's unclear. Maybe the sponge goes out of it. I mean, even if you could put it back together, it seems like the sponge went out of existence. But maybe no living part of the sponge went out of existence. So maybe it just ceased to exist without dying.
So you said, I guess tardigrades look like insects. Have you not seen what a tardigrade looks like?
I have not.
Yeah, we need to get your live reaction to seeing the pictures of these things for the first time. We've got to hear it.
Okay. Now that I've Googled it, I have seen these. I have seen depiction of these. I just didn't remember or associate the name with these pictures. But my goodness, they are adorable. I don't know why there aren't more plushes of these for children or why they're not the center of like children's television shows. Adorable little creatures.
You don't think they look freaky?
Oh no, of course. I mean, yeah, of course they do. They look like they haunt my nightmares. Yeah. As soon as I Googled it and saw the picture, it revived the memory in me of seeing those pictures before. I must have suppressed it because they look so horrifying.
Okay, I actually have seen a stuffed tardigrade for children. I've actually seen that.
Really? Amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, so I think a zombie snail is another candidate for something that's neither dead nor alive. You know what this is? This is way more horrifying than tardigrades. I mean, this is horrifying enough that it belongs in the discussion of natural evil if we're going to do the problem of evil in a philosophy of religion class. So you can look this up, although later on YouTube, you'll get some videos of this. I already Googled it.
I'm looking at photos of alleged zombie snails. What's so horrible about them? They look weird. Is there something else that I should be concerned about?
Yes. So here's the deal with those things. They look weird. It's not a species of snail. It is a snail that has a parasite in it that grows inside of it into a worm, and then the worm takes over its antenna and causes it to go to the top of a tree branch or something where it will be eaten by a certain species of bird, and then the parasite will then continue its life cycle in the gut of the bird. And through the droppings, the snails will pick up more baby parasites that will take over it and turn it into a zombie. But yeah, it's really freaky. And then just before they get eaten by the worm, they stretch out and make the snail's head look like a worm that is attractive to the bird. It's the most grotesque thing in nature, I swear. But that's a thing that I think. Is a snail in that state alive? I mean, not really. It's not in control of its own biological functioning. Its biological functioning has been co-opted for the life cycle of another creature.
Yeah, that's a really interesting example that I have been spared of until this moment. And it's horrifying, and it shows why nature is overrated.
Yeah, that'll take your love of nature down a few notches, hearing about that one, I've got to say. So I guess I want to move on then to discussions of the badness of death or the lack thereof. Maybe we should talk about these arguments from Epicurus that death is not a harm for the person who dies. And it just, they strike me. They're like some of these arguments, like Anselm's ontological argument strikes me this way. It's like, you should be hit by the fact that this some kind of trick is being pulled on you, and your job is to figure out what the trick is, because obviously this kind of reasoning can't work. Why don't you go ahead and do you want to introduce the paradoxes or should I?
Whatever your preference is. Do you have a preference?
Okay, I'll go ahead. So there is one. I think there are two distinct arguments. Maybe there's a version that puts them together, but there's the asymmetry paradox, which is the thought we look at horror about our future annihilation and the time in the world where when we don't exist, we're not around anymore, but we don't have that same horror of the time before we were born, yet it seems like that's symmetrical. So the one argument would be, well, you don't have this sort of repugnance toward the time when you weren't existing before. There's no relevant difference between this and the time after your death. Therefore, you should not have that sort of aversion or repugnance toward the time that you're dead either. And the other one is the no subject problem, or the no subject paradox, which states that you have to be present for something to harm you, right? You can't be harmed by something that is around when you're not. Like if there's a tiger that escapes from the zoo in like some other city, it can't harm me because we're not in the same place. And the thought is like, death is like this. Death can't harm you because by the time death has arrived, you're not here anymore. You're gone. So it seems like there's no subject of the harm of death for you with regard to your own death. So these two arguments, I hope I have presented them somewhat fairly, are supposed to show that death is not a harm. And there are a number of philosophers responding to show where the reasoning goes wrong with these.
Yeah, I mean, you did a very nice job summarizing both of those. So let me take them in turn. Let's start with the asymmetry one, which can be at least traced back to Lucretius, who was an Epicurean. Now, one thing I want to say as someone who's not a historian, but just reading Lucretius's epic poem De Rerum Natura, where he makes this argument, I think I can say this without being anachronistic. He, at certain parts of that poem, seems to be addressing people's fear of death. Because he mentions in the English translation, like looking, people seeing decaying corpses and sort of imposing an experience on that and feeling anxiety as a result of that. So one way to read the argument, which I think is not anachronistic, is he's arguing against the view that we should think death is intrinsically bad. Because we don't think that it was intrinsically bad for us to have lacked those experiences before we were born. That's not something that merited fear in and of itself, and non-existence after we're dead parallels that in the relevant respects, and trying to impose experience on corpses is just misleading. There's nothing going on there. And the thought is like, maybe once we recognize that, that could assuage our fear. Now on that reading of the argument, I think that is right. And this presents two versions of the argument that you see play out in the contemporary literature that John Fisher has nicely separated, but that's not always separated in the literature. So there's an attitudinal version of the symmetry argument that says our attitudes towards our prenatal and posthumous non-existence are relevantly similar. And since we shouldn't have negative attitudes towards our prenatal non-existence, and we definitely shouldn't fear it, we should have symmetrical attitudes towards our posthumous non-existence. I don't think that's a stupid argument. And then there's the kind of a evaluative version of the argument that's not about attitudes, but about whether the event that brought you into existence could be all things considered bad for you, and whether the event that takes you out of existence, namely your death, could be all things considered bad for you. And that version of the argument holds that it's not bad for you to have come into existence at the time that you were rather than earlier. And since we should think these things are symmetrical, we should likewise think that it's not bad for you to go out of existence the time you will rather than later. And it's that version of the argument that I think does not work. There's some trick that's going on there, and that can be revealed by being more precise in our characterization of the argument itself. Okay, so the relevant sense of bad for, I think, has to be all things considered bad, which includes not only intrinsic harms, but being deprived of intrinsic goods. On my view, and the most popular view in the literature, death is bad only extrinsically, only insofar as it prevents you from missing out on additional good life. Now, you might think, could the event that brings you into existence be bad for the same reason? Because it deprives you of additional good life. And that actually is a tricky question. So for most people, they're going to think, no, that is not bad for me. It wasn't bad for me to be born at the time that I was rather than another time. And there's different explanations you can give of that. So I was born in 1986. Would it have been good for me to have been born in 1976? Well, not obviously, because if I were born 10 years earlier, chances are I would die 10 years earlier and I wouldn't have more good life. I might even have less good life if I think life where I'm deprived of modern technology and medicine. I mean, not that like 1970s didn't have that, but it was less good. I mean, it's a continuous scale. And who knows what the future is going to hold. And if I died 10 years earlier, I might miss out on some, you know, major breakthrough. So it's not obvious to me that it would be better if I were actually born 10 years earlier. There's also the question about how to assess the truth of that counterfactual. If I wasn't born when I was, would I have been born 10 years earlier? No, not on any straightforward reading of the truth makers of counterfactuals. In the nearest possible world where my actual birth did not occur, or whatever, you know, the time that I came into existence, I existed before I was born, is a world where I didn't exist at all, right? Because in order for me to exist, it had to be the exact sperm and egg combination that created the zygote that turned into me. And in order for that to have happened, the series of events before had to unfold in almost exactly the way that it did, right? So it's not possible, at least in a straightforward sense of physical possibility and given the fixity of the past, for me to have come into existence 10 years earlier. And that's not possible for pretty much anyone else either in that sense of possibility. Right. Now, you could construct cases, and people like Christopher Belshaw gives a case where, I mean, you have a zygote in a lab and you're thinking about implanting it now. And if you don't do it now, then you'll do it 10 years from now. And then, you know, you implant it 10 years from now and it turns into a person. And then it could be true for that person that had they not come into existence at the time they did, they would have come into existence 10 years earlier. Okay. So the relevant sense, I think, is thinking about those cases. And in those cases where it's really true that had the actual event that not brought you into existence not happened, then you would have been born earlier and you would have had a longer, better life. Then I think you really were deprived of additional intrinsic good. And that really could warrant negative attitudes. It's just not the situation that many of us find ourselves in. For almost everybody that's thinking about this, if we didn't come into existence at the time we did, we wouldn't have existed at all. Okay. So one more thing that I want to say about this, I want to get your reaction, and then I can go on to the no subject argument. Right. So on my view, there's not much to be said for the fact that if we that the worlds in which we existed earlier and had a longer, better life are very far away, right? I don't want to restrict the relevant range of comparison to those worlds, because if I do that, then you could make a symmetry argument that we'd have to do the same thing about death. And that, I think, is not a way that people would want to go upon reflection. So if you imagine, and maybe this is getting a little bit science fiction-y, somebody that's in such chronic pain that they have a constant net negative well-being as a result of some genetic condition, the world in which they exist and have a very positive well-being would be very far away. It might even be that there's no possible world where they exist and have a net positive well-being if the suffering is a result of a genetic condition and their genes are a necessary condition for them to have come into existence in the first place, right? But nevertheless, I think they're warranted in having negative attitudes towards their net bad life and longing for a very good life, even if the world in which they live a very good life is a counter possible or it's very, very far away. Okay. So then if I'm going to be, you know, symmetrical, I'd have to say the same thing about birth. So why couldn't someone wish that they were born much, much earlier in time and had a much longer, better life, even if the world in which that happens is very, very far away, right? And there are far away worlds where that could happen. I mean, could imagine a shorter period of time between the Big Bang and the creation of the Milky Way galaxy, and everybody's death date being held fixed in external time. That's a possible world, maybe merely metaphysically possible, and it's very far away. But that fact, I don't think prevents us from having a fitting attitude towards missing out on the good that comes from that world. Okay. So anyway, that's a long way of saying someone could still press me on my view and say, well, if you're not, if you're admitting those worlds for your death that are very far away, if you can lament that, I want to live in a world where I'm immortal or I live hundreds of thousands of years of a happy life. I do want that. And I regret that I don't get it or I'm not going to. But it's very far away. Why can't I do the same thing about worlds that are very far away where I was born earlier? Okay. So my answer to that is you can. You can do that. And it's perfectly fitting to do that. But I don't, and most people don't, because they don't care about those worlds over alternative worlds where they have a much higher well-being. So in actuality, they just want more good life. And they're indifferent between whether that more good life comes holding their birth date fixed and tacking on extra life at the end, or holding their death date fixed and tacking on extra life at the beginning. In fact, most prefer holding their birth date fixed and tacking on extra life at the end, because in the salient versions of those cases that we imagine, our thick self is held fixed, so to speak. So that's a way of saying the things that have affected our the type of person that we are, not the conditions for personal identity, but just the type of person that we are things that we have an attachment to. And this, I mean, Elizabeth Harmon has written on this. Frederick Kaufman has. Nagel, I think, was the first one to make this sort of argument in the context of death. But I mean, there's lots of things about me that aren't necessary for my personal identity to be maintained. I like philosophy a lot. I'm a huge fan of The Simpsons, not, you know, super original, I know. I'm a vegetarian. I have a certain group of friends. I live in New York. I like to see plays. I mean, there's all sorts of things about my interest that would be different if I were born at a different time. I would have different friends that would have led me down a different path. I very well could have picked a different career. The bands that I listen to would be different, you know, the genre of music that I enjoy, the films, all of that stuff. People have an attachment to that. And the most salient alternatives to the actual life where we maintain all of that, but have more well-being, are worlds where we hold our birth date fixed and then extend our death date. But if someone really had a different set of preferences and they wanted to, you know, they're a historian that was, oh, I, you know, I'm so fascinated by the 1950s or something. I wish I were born in the 1950s and then got to live forever. I think that that's a perfectly reasonable attitude to have. It's just given our psychological dispositions, that's not going to describe what the actual person wants. Okay, so that's a long rambling answer, but that's how I would understand the symmetry argument and then take down the version of it that has to do with the badness of death rather than our attitudes.
Okay, so you make two assumptions that bear on the modal considerations that I want to challenge. One is you seem to be accepting the essence of origins sort of story where you are necessarily the product of like a particular sperm and a particular egg. And then also you seem to assume that like that particular sperm and particular egg both could not have come to be together and create you except in a very, very narrow range of circumstances. There aren't a lot of nearby worlds where those would have found each other, you know? I don't know about either of those. Like the second one, it just seems too hard to compute. I don't know how you could feel so confident about that. And the first one, it seems like is actually wrong. I mean, it seems like I could have had slightly different colored hair. That seems like it's true. I'd have to have different DNA for that to be true, I think, or make it eye color or something like that. Imagine some physical feature of me was slightly different. That seems like a way the world could be, and it would still be me, and it wouldn't be a lookalike. And likewise, like, it doesn't seem like I could be my genes, because I could have had a biological twin. There could be two people with my genes, and I couldn't have been both of them. So, I'm a little skeptical of the story that I am the product of a particular sperm and a particular egg, And I'm also just not sure how you would compute like the rarity of that happening. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, these are good things to push me on. I'm not. You're absolutely right that I was assuming those in my response to the symmetry argument. I didn't mean to suggest that I'm super confident that either of those claims are right. Philosophy is hard, and I'm not super confident in most philosophical theses that I accept in the sense of being more confident in them than alternatives. Right. So you could have a different color hair. There's certainly a sense in which that counterfactual is true. So you're right that I make both of those assumptions in my response. I'm not, and didn't mean to imply that I'm super confident in either of those claims. Philosophy's hard. And for difficult questions, my credences tend to be split between lots of viable views. But I am more confident in that than its alternatives. And I think I'm more confident, at least in a sense that's necessary for my argument, than the alternatives. So are there logically possible worlds where a numerically identical sperm or numerically distinct sperm fertilizes the same egg in question and results in a zygote with slightly different DNA that leads to a different hair color? Would that be you? I'm inclined to say no, but even if it would across possible worlds, I wonder if in the actual world it's true that had we not come from the zygote that we in fact did, then there's nothing that, parents or their parents or their parents' parents and so on could have done to have brought us into existence where personal identity was maintained. And that claim I'm more confident in than one that makes those conditions strong enough to concern cross-world personal identity. So I think that would be enough for my argument to go through. And if it turns out that I'm wrong, then I would make my view even more permissive than it is now, which is to say, well, if you wanted to be in that nearby possible world where you existed with red hair and were born 5 minutes earlier or whatever, or 9 months earlier or 10 years earlier, and you would have had a longer, better life, I think that's a perfectly fitting attitude to have to regret missing out on that. Even if it turns out that such worlds are fairly close.
So I was also wondering this, which is suppose you have technology keeps improving and life expectancy keeps going up and quality of life keeps going up gradually, like forever. Okay. So, and suppose you only get to be born once. There's no reincarnation. So if it happens that the sperm and the egg, like this, an identical sperm and identical egg combine in the future, that will just create somebody very Travis-like, but it won't be you. Okay, so given that assumption, there's this weird thing. Like, you're being born in 1986 seems like, in one sense, it's a misfortune, because if you were born in 2086, you would have had, like, a longer, better life. And if you were born then, well, that seems like a misfortune, because if you were born in 2186, well, then, you know, and so on. So it seems like under those conditions, being born is actually like could be described as a harm just as much as your death. It's like it's an event that gives you life, but it's also an event that limits how much good you have in your life.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That setup reminds me of the paradox about the like everlasting wine bottle. So you have like a bottle of wine that gets twice as good every single day and you're going to live forever. And then there's a question about like, is it rational to open it on any day? You might think no, because whatever day you choose to open it, if you just waited one more day, it would have gotten better. And that's just going to, compound exponentially if you're living forever. But then if you never open it, that seems like the worst option of all of them. So the introducing the infinite in that case, I think, presents that, that puzzle. But it also, the example is nice because it also illustrates something else that I think is really interesting and underappreciated about the badness of death. Which is you should not care about how extrinsically bad it is, except insofar as it makes a difference to your net receipt of intrinsic goods. So that's very abstract, but the thought is if you can get any more additional value in your life, you should take on any amount of extrinsic disvalue to get that good. So like in a sense, that would any time that you're born would be maybe all things considered very bad for you, because if you weren't born then, you would have been born later and then had even more good life. But you should be happy, all things considered, that you were born and that you have a net good life, and you should be willing to trade any finite amount of good life for any amount of extrinsic disvalue. To use the philosopher's term, there'd be a lexically prior relationship between the two. So that's all abstract, but like here's a case that I think illustrates that, and then I'll see what you think about that. So suppose that somebody is taking a plane somewhere, and the plane is crashing, and then they're going to possibly die. And if they don't die in the plane crash, they know, let's suppose, that they'll die tomorrow in a car crash, right? But if they survive the plane crash and die in a car crash, what would happen if they hadn't died in the car crash is that they would have lived, let's say, like 100 more years and then died in a train crash. This poor, unfortunate person. So the setup is if they don't die right now, they'll get one extra day of good life. And then if they don't die that tomorrow, then they'll get, you know, an extra 100 years of good life. And the crucial thing is the death now is much less bad for them than their death would be tomorrow, because the amount that it would deprive you of would be one day rather than 100 years. And the point is like, but that doesn't matter at all, except insofar as it makes a difference to how much good they get in their life. And you get one extra day of good if you take on the death that's much, much, much worse. So the badness of death really in itself does not matter, except insofar as it gives you extra good life. You should be willing to make your death as bad as possible, maybe even infinitely bad, if it gives you extra good life. So if someone tells me, you know, I can give you this like medical treatment that will extend your life by 10 years, but the downside is it means that you'll die rather than being immortal. Do you want that? Say, yes, please give me the extra 10 years of good life, even if it deprives me of an infinite amount of good life. It's still more good life. All right, so I think that the example that you give nicely brings out that point.
All right, now let's hear what you have to say about the no subject problem.
Yeah, so that one, I think, is more of a sleight of hand than the symmetry argument. And really, I think the question of when the subject is harmed or when death is bad for you is underspecified. And what the Epicurean benefits from is a trade-off between different senses of bad for, such that no matter how you answer the question, they can pick one precise sense of bad for where the answer to that question seems implausible. You might say, like, well, how could your death be bad for you once you no longer exist? And the implicit background assumption is that the bad form question is intrinsic. And you might wonder, well, how could something be intrinsically bad for you at a time that you don't exist and then don't have any intrinsic properties, right? Okay. So really what I think is when someone asks you the question, when some Epicurean tries to pull this trick on you and say, when is your death bad for you? They really could mean something more precise. And if we go through each of the precise questions that they could be asking and the deprivationist has a straightforward answer to it, then there's no problem at all. So I'll just go over, I think, the salient ones. Maybe they're not exhaustive, but I have a paper in the Australasian Journal of Philosophy where I go over the ones that the list that I think is exhaustive. And then I try to show on each of these more precise questions, there's a straightforward answer to give that's not problematic at all. Right. One thing you might be asking is, what time is it true that somebody's momentary well-being is higher than it otherwise would have been? That's what you might mean when death is bad. So when is it true that had your actual death not occurred, you would be better off at that time than you would be if your death occurred? And the answer to that question depends upon whether deceased people have well-being levels. In a way that you might analogously wonder, do deceased people have wealth? Or do they have $0, or do they have no net wealth? And whatever the answers to that question, it's a tricky metaphysical question. There's a straightforward answer to this question about death. So if deceased people have well-being levels of zero, as people like Neil Fite think, then the answer to that question is the times that you would have been alive had your actual death not occurred and had a positive well-being level. It's just obviously true, conditional on the assumption that the deceased have well-being levels. If the deceased do not have well-being levels, there's not even a well-being level of zero, it just doesn't make sense to ascribe to them a well-being level, then the answer to that question is at no time. But that's not problematic to say. Your death could still be extrinsically bad for you, and it could be the case that there's no time that your momentary well-being level is lower than it would be had your actual death not occurred, because there's just it's undefined to compare some value to no value at all, right? So that then the answer sort of seems weird, but once you think about the question being asked, it's actually not weird at all. The other thing you could ask is, what time is it true that somebody's like total well-being, that the amount of good that they've had in their whole life, what time is it true that that is lower than it would be had their actual death not occurred? Fred Feldman gives the answer at all times. But he seems to be assuming, and that whatever makes it true that one world was actualized rather than a different world where you lived a longer life, that was true for all times. So I don't know if counterfactual determinism is true, but if it is, then Fred Feldman's answer to that question is spot on and uncontroversial. Now, you might question that and say, no, I think, you know, the truth makers of these claims are different, or it'd be indeterminate for a while, and then maybe it'd be terminate at some later point in time. And then I say, okay, well, you know, whatever the answer to this metaphysical question that you give, then that'll just fill in the answer to this question about when is it true that your total well-being is lower in the actual world than the other. And that shouldn't be problematic by my interlocutor's lights, whatever their commitments are. Okay. And then the last question that you might be asking is, what time does death occur? And that's a distinct question that depends on what the correct criterion of death is. That's controversial for the reasons that we gave before. So is it when entropy overwhelms homeostasis, or when the homeostasis stops, or is it when there's a death of or you have irreversible cessation of the brain function, or is it something else? Again, I don't know. But whatever the answer to that question is, there'll be a straightforward answer to this question about when is it true that the bad event of death occurs. And there's other more precise questions you can be asking too. I think there's a straightforward answer to all of them. So the challenge for the Epicurean then is to tell me precisely what you mean when you're asking the question, when is death bad for the person that dies, such that I can't give an answer to that question that doesn't commit me to some implausible metaphysical claims. And I don't think there is a way to do that.
So I'm thinking now of a case like the one you described, where your actual death is due to one thing, like suppose you're killed by Mike Myers in the actual world, but had you not, you would have been killed by Jason Voorhees 2 days later. So the question, when are you harmed by your actual death? Well, you're harmed in those 2 days, because you would have had a life worth living for those 2 days, but then after that, you're no longer being harmed by your death, because your well-being would be zero anyway because of this other cause of death. So, what do you think of that case?
Yeah, I think that's a very good and interesting objection to the deprivation view, which says that your death is bad for you extrinsically insofar as it prevents you from getting these additional goods. And then you can ask about cases where the event of your death is overdetermined, or the event of your death preempts a death that you would have had a short while later. So like the horror case, you can, for people that are averse to fictional cases, I'm not, you can give, I think, very plausible, realistic cases as well. One that's appears in the literature a lot is a case of somebody dying in war. Civil War soldiers killed, and had they not been killed in that battle, they would have been killed in a battle 2 days later. something along those lines. And then my favorite view of the badness of death, and the most popular one, would say that that person's death wasn't very bad for them because it only prevented them from missing out on a couple days of good life. And you can, furthermore, to really like twist the knife for people that like this view, you can prevent your friends' deaths from being bad for them by overdetermining their death. So I consider a case in a paper where your friend needs a kidney transplant, let's say. This is a slight variation of it. And if they get the kidney transplant, they'll live, let's say, decades longer of good life. But you can't procure the kidney transplant for them, unfortunately. They're too far down the list and they're going to die very soon. But what you can do is you can overdetermine their death by hiring the equivalent of like a counterfactual intervener. So you hire someone to torture them for the remainder of their life, if and only if they don't die at the time they in fact die. And now what you've done is made the nearest possible world where their actual death doesn't occur is one where they have a net negative life. So not only have you prevented their death from being bad for them, you've made it quite good for them. And that seems bad. They shouldn't be excited by this news. If you go into the hospital with some balloons and you tell them good news and like, you got me a kidney, you're like, no, but I made your death very, very good for you. You should be looking forward to this, right? That shouldn't change their attitudes at all. Okay. So what I want to say, and what's been said by other people in the literature, is that this is actually the right result. So let me say first why it's the right result, and then I'll give a kind of further argument for that claim. One thing to do to sugar the pill is to appeal to a plural account of harm. And Neil Feit has a book that just came out with Oxford in 2023 called Bad Things, where he defends, I think, the most sophisticated, plausible version of this view. So we don't have to get into the weeds here, but the general idea is take the soldier case. While the death in the first battle was not very bad for the soldier, the conjunction of events that would put him in a situation where if he doesn't die in this battle, he'd die in this battle, those together are bad for him. So if those two events didn't happen, then maybe he would have lived a longer, happier life. Or maybe he was just overdetermined again and again and again, but there's some event, maybe what put him in the Civil War rather than not being in the war at all. That event was very bad for him. Then he would have lived a much longer, happier life. So that's the way that I want to go here. Now, to try to motivate that a little bit more, think about this patient who's about to die. And if they don't die, they would now be tortured indefinitely. It shouldn't bring them comfort that you did this. And it shouldn't bring them comfort that you did it because it doesn't change the net receipt of intrinsic goods in their life, right? So this goes back to the badness of death doesn't matter except insofar as it changes how much good you get in your life. You haven't changed how much good this person gets in their life when you do that. You've just made this possible world that would be actualized different than the you made the nearest possible world where the actual death doesn't occur different than it otherwise would be. But suppose that they can, they can procure the kidney. Should they want that to avoid death? I think quite clearly no. Not if they can't prevent the torturer now. So you're like, you hire this torturer. Now you're like, oh, I don't have the contact information. I don't know how to stop them. They should not want the kidney because their death really is in fact good for them. And if you deny that and you want to insist, as some people do, that their death would nevertheless be bad for them, even though you've changed what would happen if their actual death didn't occur, then you either have to say, it'd be prudent for them to continue living and undergo the torture, which is a non-starter because I'm stipulating that it brings their subsequent life down to a net negative level. Or, and this is what's problematic, you'd have to sever the connection between how good or bad your death is for you and the prudential reason that you have to seek or avoid it. I think really you've made it the case that they have prudential reason to seek their death if they can only seek it or avoid it. They also have prudential reason to avoid their death and stop the torturer. But if they can't do that, then their death really is good for them. Likewise, if the soldier could only prevent their death and then live another 2 days, they have prudential reason to do that, but much less prudential reason than if they could avoid that death and then the counterfactual death that they would succumb to 2 days later. If they could prevent both of that and live longer, then that generates even more reason to avoid both of those things. So I think an essential insight of the deprivation view is that it captures this connection between the reason that we have to seek or avoid good or bad events in a way that alternative views cannot.
That's interesting. So it seems like the deprivation view sort of has to be right in a way. Like I guess I agree with you, at least as far as comparing the other views about the badness of death, like the Epicureanism and annihilationism. I know you've got this argument against the view that death is intrinsically bad. Maybe we'll get to that. But it just seems like view that death is bad for us because of what it deprives us of. It seems like that's the only way to go, and yet it still has these weird results. I wonder, like, we started to hint at this earlier. So it seems like the wrongness of killing is plausibly explained by the amount of value that you diminish in the other person's life. But suppose we had some supercomputer that could tell when all of these overdetermination events happened, right? Like, should we release a bunch of convicted murderers out of prison because it turns out that the people they killed only had a day to live anyway? And like, oh, we found out that you only took a day of this person's life. Now the punishment seems disproportionate. We should, you know, we should commute the sentences so that they should all be released now. I don't know. What do you think of that proposal?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I'd want to give a different case to try to defend deprivationism, and then I'll come back to the releasing the prisoners one. So I think a very plausible moral principle that's to a large extent theory neutral. It's the principle of pairwise comparison of harms, and there's different ways to formulate it, but the rough idea is all else equal, if you can prevent one of two harms, and one harm is significantly worse than the other, then you should prevent the worse harm. And the all else equal clause is supposed to account for things like desserts. So if one person deserves and the other doesn't, or if there's questions of distributive justice or so on, so we're imagining everything's equal, you can prevent one of two, you should prevent the one that's substantially worse than the one that's substantially less bad. And if you accept the deprivation view of the badness of death, which assumes this certain account of harm, the counterfactual comparative account of harm, then you would get that if you could prevent one of two deaths and one death is substantially worse than the other, then you should prevent the substantially worse death. And that seems exactly right to me. So if we have this supercomputer, I think as you put it, that can tell us which deaths are overdetermined, and you're in a position where you have to cause one of two people to die, there's no third option to prevent anyone from dying. But you know, if I cause person A to die, that will be overdetermined. There's a million other people doing it too. And if I cause person B to die, I will be preventing person B from living, you know, 100 years of good life. It seems to me quite clear that you should prevent person A from dying. And a good explanation of that is something like the pairwise comparison, the principle of the pairwise comparison of harms. Okay. So does this mean we should let prisoners out who were convicted for murder, but it turns out that the people that they murdered had overdetermined deaths? Well, I think no. But that's all, or at least not obviously. And the reason is wanting to punish prisoners or the punishment isn't supposed to and shouldn't be neatly tracking how harmful their actions were. So you might want it in as a deterrent for other people. You might want as a matter of dessert, maybe you think they deserve it if they don't know the death is overdetermined. They thought that they were doing something really bad, or they would have, even if the death wasn't overdetermined, and that indicates a really bad moral character and they should be punished for that reason. So I'm not even assuming, say, a retributive account of punishment, but just that there's a range of explanations for why we might want to punish people that it includes retributive considerations that, would allow us to say we should still keep those prisoners in prison, even if it turns out that they killed somebody whose death was overdetermined. But this raises another issue that I think is a serious problem in the public that not a lot of people have thought about, but a few philosophers in the literature, the death literature, have written about, which is it's often assumed that the death penalty is the worst punishment. And that there's a lot of opposition to that in virtue of the fact that it's supposedly the worst punishment that you can give someone. But if the deprivation view is right, it's actually how bad it is going to vary tremendously from prisoner to prisoner. And we punish a lot of people to a much greater extent than some people on death row. So if you lock away a young person for their life and the quality of life in prison is much lower than it would be out of prison, that's going to hurt them a lot more than taking, say, we find a Nazi that's living now and they're in their late 90s and then we put them to death. I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that. I'm just saying that if the deprivation view is right, their death is much less bad for them than being locked away in prison for life for somebody that's very young. And as a sort of outsider to this literature about the death penalty, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of discussion about that. I can't say that for certain in the academic literature, but in the public sphere, there's almost no discussion of that. Let's just assume that the death penalty is the worst thing that could happen to you and lots of other punishments that are unquestionably harsher, that hurt prisoners more, are ones that have widespread acceptance across the political spectrum.
Yeah, right. Like if it turns out that your well-being is diminished to the being below zero when you're in prison, then the death penalty is a mercy because it spared you all that negative utility. Well, Travis, this is really an amazing conversation, but I have a class I got to prep for. I'm getting nervous about it, and I hate to break it off right when I think like we're really cooking with oil. What do you think?
Well, I mean, you got to prep for class. I understand. I got to go teach philosophy at death, so this has been a really good primer for that.
You have any final thought you'd like to bring up?
Well, let me see. I guess I would close by saying I think that thinking through questions about the philosophy of death is something that is not only interesting, but has proven to have practical value, not only for the philosophers that do it, but for the students that teach it. So I'd encourage anyone that's casually interested in it to start going through the literature on their own. And if they want to start, a good place to do it is to pick up any reader. I am, however, partial to my reader, Exploring the Philosophy of Death and Dying. So I would encourage people, if they wanted, to buy many, many, many copies of that. It makes a good holiday gift.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. Well, all good things come to an end, just like your life. So thank you for joining me, Travis, and thank you all for listening, those of you who have listened this far.